Thalia Peterson has been an artist that has fascinated me for so many years. And when I saw her work at the last Art Basel, I remember feeling so included and so seen. And I think that's what has been amazing for me about experiencing and enjoying her work is the way she's explored identity. She grew up during apartheid in South Africa, and then her father was a political exile. She studied at Central Saint Martin in London. And then, in her various themes that she unpacks in her practice, she also shared with me her royal origins. But I think what you'll be most excited to hear about is her various theories on the origin of the passion gap. Tanya, I've been waiting for this moment for so long. I think you know that I've also been waiting for this moment for so long because every time I've seen you over the last couple of months, years, I've tried to corner you and say, would you please be my first guest? And here you are. Thank you for being part of this conversation.
Thank you.
I wanted to say, for me, when I saw your work the first time, I was intrigued. The second time, I was even more intrigued. And then there I am, standing at Art Basel, feeling like, does anybody actually see me here? And I walked and I stood in front of your beautiful work and I thought, Tanya Peterson, there you've gone and again taken our messages to the world and made it really, really relevant in the different contexts. Tell me about your journey. Where do you come from?
Firstly, thank you, Joanne. I'm feeling so flattered. Stop it. I like it.
Like it. I even put in a red lip for you because I knew I was speaking to Tanya Peterson. You know, your red lip. I love it.
Oh, well, I mean, my journey with art, is that what you're asking about? Well, I guess my journey with art, there's no beginning. I mean, it's just always been it's a part of me, isn't it? It's like, I mean, I always think it's like athletes, isn't it? Like, you know, they don't start becoming athletes. Your body's just in tune to existing in the world in a certain way. And I think for artists, it's the same. It's not like a career choice, or it's just that you exist in the world in a certain way. You kind of made a certain way, I think. You kind of tuned into the world in a certain way. And I think that is what makes artists artists, not a career. You know, there's so many artists who have no career. Because of markets or whatever it is, but they're still very important people, you know, that make the world what it is. So, my journey, I mean, I've always just known and been and practiced art.
You are art. I mean, that's the thing for me, is that you're always telling a story in everything that you do. And for me, it was interesting because, of course, it is one of those things. You see yourself reflected in others. And to me, we could be sisters, you know? And it's so exciting in that sense to see you represent South African art, because I think the concept of South African art has also, to me, become more and more. It's been something that I've been grappling with, identity, which is a theme that you often explore in your work. It's something that, for me, coming from an ex-beauty queen background, I'm always trying to be politically correct. I love how you actually do the opposite. You say what needs to be said, which I appreciate. You know, it's also helped me to realize how to speak my truths when it needs be. But how did your journey start in terms of you ending up studying in London, for example? How did that all happen as a girl from Cape Town?
Okay, so my father was a political exile, and he went into exile when I was 4 years old. We were not allowed to leave the country. I mean, we were not allowed to get our passports or any of those things. And the first time we were allowed to leave was when I was 9 years old. So I was nine, my sister was 16, and then we went over to my dad. And I remember the first thing, I mean, I remember coming into London and everybody was taking photos of like the Big Ben and Buckingham Palace. And my sister and I, we were just like amazed at like the white people, like cleaning the bins and, you know, like white people in labor. Like, I think our whole album when we came home was like white people in labor. So
actually, I remember the first
it was
time
like,
as well. I
it
saw, I
was
was like, oh.
amazing. It was like,
Yeah.
wow.
Yeah. It's a different concept if you grew up here during apartheid, which both of us did.
Totally. Absolutely. And it was still apartheid in that time. So, you know, we were so separate. We knew nothing about the other communities around us. We just grew up within our own community. So I went to London, and it was completely like it was a culture shock. Mm. You know, you go into a multicultural space and a school that's completely diverse. Mm. And not diverse in the way we understand diversity here, where everybody ticks a box and six of this is allowed and 10 of that is allowed into a classroom, you know, but properly diverse spaces. And so I think it was amazing. It shaped how I see the world. It shaped how I make art. It shaped what I think is right and wrong from a very young age, because when I returned to South Africa, I could very quickly understand that this is wrong on all levels.
So you went when you were 9?
Yeah.
And you came back when you were?
So I came back for the first time quite quickly. I came back about a year or two later. Mm-hmm. I didn't really like London at that time. I missed my family. You know, I missed my mom. I probably missed Athlone.
You missed the food, because I follow you on Instagram. I can see you love the food as much as I do. And I mean, we'll get into that later on. But when I went to your home and we had that amazing food and a lot of the food that I recognize as Makos,
yeah, exactly. You know,
there is something nostalgic about taste and about food that does always bring you home.
Yeah, but it's amazing because I remember whenever we used to go to London, I mean, in those times, the travel laws was much more slack. But we literally used to go over with cooler bags as if there was no food in London. You know, with like smoked snook and crayfish and like crazy things like processed meats that like all of which you could get in London. But okay, you can't get smoked snook in London.
You can't. I was about to say that's one thing I don't think.
Actually, it's still relevant. It's still relevant, guys. If I could, I'll still take that cooler bag. So
so you came back home. You came back to our land of tastes.
Yes.
But your tastes had also then changed because you'd had a bit of a view of the world. Like you said, it shaped your views.
Yeah, I guess. But then I started living between the two because my mom was always here and my dad was always there. Mm-hmm. So it was quite loose, you know. Sometimes I was here, sometimes I was there. Mm-hmm. And it remained like that until I left when I was about 17. And then I didn't return again until about 12 years later, like something like that. But very much my entire like young adulthood was spent in London and traveling. And then I returned when I was about, I don't know, 26 or 27. I can't even remember. I try not to remember my age.
It's okay. I also age.
I'm still 27.
We are still 27 plus VAT. That's what I tell everyone. We've got our own VAT. For me, I remember as and this is another thing I want to touch on as a colored, as a Creole, because I'm very interested also in how you define who you are. And when I remember, my cousin came back from Germany. She was the first exchange student in our country who went overseas. I don't know if overseas was a big thing. And you came back and you sort of looked at her like, oh, you've changed. Did it change you for the better to have seen so much, or did it make you frustrated when you came back and realized that there was still such a long way to go?
Both. Mm. Both. But also, you know, it's funny you say that, because I remember the first day that I went to Central St. Martin's. And how old was I? I was about 19 or 20 or something. And they asked us to do a project on identity. And I went home and I was like, oh my God, what do I do? And the only thing I could think of was Kusisters.
But this is, so you posted a thing of Kusisters and I'm like, I mean, I was actually thinking was my like, plan was to get you some warm Kusisters when you came in here, but I failed.
And I was really disturbed by this because I thought to myself, we are not just a plate of Kusisters. You know, we are not, although now I don't mind being just a plate of Kusisters because actually it's good enough. But,
I totally hear you. And I think
I became quite desperate to be able to explain who I am. Mm. And the fact that I lacked the vocabulary, I lacked the knowledge of our history is what really propelled me to look deeper into it, is because I couldn't answer the questions that they were asking me about who I am, where we come from, what's our cultural practices. And then you're like, what? And then after a while you're like, no, I do have all these things. You know what I mean? It just, you know, we just not maybe seeing it in the way that we should. And maybe apartheid had a lot to do with that, because it made us feel as though our actual cultural practices was not good enough, as though it wasn't cultural in a sense, but uncultural, if that makes sense. And then it was just about reframing how we see ourselves. Mm. And then I was like, wow, no, we're amazing. Oh, my God, we're so amazing.
But it is interesting what you say, because I remember as a colored girl growing up during apartheid, when people asked you about your history, often you were baffled. You didn't quite know how to describe it. And also, you would always try to say, oh, but you know, my grandparents came from Europe or something like that. Because that almost justified your place or uplifted your standing in society at that point in time.
Absolutely.
So our identities, it took a while for me also. I'm still grappling and not grappling. That's the wrong word. But I'm still learning who I am. And I think also having children now who have an extra layer of complexity when it comes to identity, it does drive the point home. But speaking of layers of identity, you went back and you traced your ancestry back to an Indonesian prince.
Yes.
And that also informed a lot of your work, I think.
Yes.
Your pieces that I saw at Zeit as part of the permanent collection. Yes. I saw you in this beautiful long red sort of regal looking garment. Tell me about that part of your history and how that informed your identity too.
Well, you know, I think there's so many descendants of Tuan Guru in Cape Town, not just me. And so it's something we always grow up. It's something we know, you know.
It's just to give context for the listeners. Okay.
Tuan Guru was a prince from the island of Tidore, and that was a part of the Spice Islands. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Spice Islands was the most sought after place during colonialism, and you know, within Southeast Asia, because nutmeg and pepper and cloves was more valuable than gold. Mm. And so they had come from these islands, and of course the Dutch wanted the spices, but they raped and pillaged and do what they do. Mm. And the people who then formed a resistance against them were imprisoned and exiled and brought to the Cape and put in Robben Island. A lot of them were put in Robben Island. Some were taken to India. But our ancestors specifically were brought to the Cape. Tuan Guru was one of many who were brought to the Cape. And what I discovered and what was so amazing was that we were always told that we come from people who were enslaved. And yes, that is true, but it's not the whole truth. Mm. Our truth, our history is so much more complicated than that. And so to push back against that, when I discovered that he was a prince, I was like, oh, God, no.
We always knew you were royal, darling. No, but I hear you. And it is such a powerful story
as well.
It's
a powerful story because it just complicates our story as the people of the Cape. Mm. You know, we do come from a history of people who were educated, who were sophisticated, who were, you know, who were of all stages and places within society. We come from complex societies, ancient societies, and we carry all of this in within us, within our blood, within our memory, within our genetics, you know. And it's not frivolous. It's true. We inherit this. Mm. And so we need to walk tall and we need to walk proud, because it's something
I put my shoulders back now at that point. But let's walk tall.
Because no matter what people take away from us, whether it's our land, whether it's displacement, whether it's our houses, they cannot take away what we innately have inherited, which is this amazing history and this amazing genetics. Mm. We come from fighters. Mm. And that's why we're still here. That's why we're having this podcast. That's why we're wearing red lipstick.
Are we wearing our red lipstick?
That's why we're so amazing.
You take your art and you bring it to the people, because that was my thing. I mean, for example, even the whole idea of the passion gap. So just to put into context as well, I was very fortunate to come to your home, and we had a chance with the BMW Young Collectors, which is a program where we're looking at developing a new sort of cohort of collectors, new young collectors in the country and on the continent. But we came to your home and you spoke to us as well about the passion gap, something that features quite a lot in Kasaram, which is a film I also want to unpack with you.
Yeah.
But you also came and brought us some of the truths that we were told in a different way. Our truths are not always our truths.
Well, it's never our truths.
So tell me, for example, the passion gap. Please tell me that story.
Okay, so my work, because what I do is I sort of try and unearth our histories. Mm-hmm. But we can't look in textbooks and stuff like that because we're not going to find what we're looking for.
Yeah, the textbooks were not written by us.
No, and most of the time nothing was written by us, you know, very little. And so we need to kind of decode our landscape. And so we look at our practices. Mm-hmm. And one of the practices which I noticed is the fact that we and a lot of people within our community, not myself, pull out their four front teeth. I started wanting to know why. Mm-hmm. Why is it? What are they preserving? What does this practice mean? Because we preserve our history within ourselves, within what we cook, in what we do, in how we dress. You know, these, you have to, it's almost like investigative journalism.
Mm-hmm. I get you.
And so, and then I found there was three origin stories attached to the passion gap. And the one is that when settlers had first come from Europe, as a way of erasing the language and making it difficult for the indigenous people to communicate, they would extract their four front teeth. Because the language was predominantly made out of click sounds and they couldn't produce these sounds without these four front teeth. So it was literally about erasure, the most violent form. And the second part is that when people were displaced from their homes and enslaved and brought from Southeast Asia and all over the Indian Ocean, Madagascar to Cape Town, when they were enslaved onto farmlands and they would run away as a way of taking their bodies back, mm-hmm. they would extract their four front teeth. And the reason why is because they would brand them on their four front teeth. They would literally engrave and brand numbers onto their four front teeth to say which farm they belong to. And so this was sort of an act of empowerment of literally taking. And then the third reason, which is where it gets its name from, the passion gap, is they say that they, when they go into prison, they extract the four front teeth to enable better oral sex. Mm. But my argument is that the third would not exist without the first. Mm. And that the third reason is a direct reason because of what was happened, because of what has been happening. You know, nothing is our fault. Mm. Nothing. If there's violence happening amongst us, it's not because of us.
Well, it's an interesting way to look at it. But then, I mean, you've always been a very interesting woman, Tanya. And then, that again, you brought into so much of your work. I mean, there's so many cultural references, which is why when I went to your home, and you've got a, there was a story that you wanted to tell me as well about some kind of secret when I went to your home.
Oh yes,
okay. But for me, it is one of those things. I felt seen when I looked at your work.
Yes.
And I think that's an important thing for me because again, the art world is an intimidating one. It is. I think that's why I've called my podcast Audacity, because it's audacious to speak about art. Because sometimes the art world is seen as quite a place that excludes a lot of people. So to see your work and to see myself and your work and my history and pick up these references that I went, oh, we also belong, you know, that was something very powerful for me. But coming to your home and meeting your family, your kids also, yeah. and your husband who you got to work with you on Kasaram. Tell me about that.
About Kasaram or about my kids?
They go together, but yes. No, well, tell.
My kids and my husband, my mother, my whole family is involved in my practice. My practice cannot happen without my family. Mm-hmm. And my mother especially, because she brings all her friends as well. So...
Love it. Community, you know, yeah, that's part of who we are. Yes.
And also because art, and I think this is the misconception about art and the art world. The art world is a very different place. The art world is sort of this constructed space, which is very much dominated by the commercial aspect. And that's okay. You know, we need that too in order to eat and survive and, you know, kind of compensate certain areas. But that's not the arts. Mm. The arts is what we live. The arts is when your mother's in the kitchen cooking and your father's doing something in his garden, making something beautiful out of, I don't know, a thorn bush. Mm. I mean, this is art. Art is not intimidating. Art is something we embrace every single moment of the day. And we don't need to label it or call it. It's just like, it's in practice, you know. And as people of color, I believe that this is inevitably just like you can't... It's like food. Mm. You know, we dance when we're happy. We can't even control it. We can't even control the art inside of us. You just put on the music and we will dance. You know,
I'm kind of tempted to put on some music right now and dance with you because that is a very true part of who we are.
It's who we are. And so it's very sad when people think that they're not included in the arts when they actually are the makers of the art. And if you think, where does all our art come from? Our art comes from Athlone and Googs and Langa. And, you know, these are the communities where art thrives, where music thrives because we live it, you know. And so I think the art world is not what we need to aspire to. I think the arts is something we just need to understand we do.
Mm. Inherently,
you do it.
Yes.
You know, you wake up in the morning and you get dressed and you do it. Mm. Especially you, Joanne. You do it.
Look, I'm taking notes. I'm taking notes. But it's such a refreshing perspective because it is one of those things. I think when I speak to people and I say, oh, I'm trying to learn about the art world, and they go, oh, it's something that I'm quite curious about, but I've never had the guts to check it out more. And people sort of think of the art world as this very moneyed world where everything is about currency, and actually it's about existing.
It's about existing. It's in practice. Art is how we exist in practice. Mm. Okay.
So Tanya, I'm going to have to, I mean, earlier we were chatting before and you told me there's a secret you had to tell me. So I'm going to ask you to tell me now while we are filming or recording, what is the secret?
No, because I wanted to tell you, but I thought you wouldn't believe me.
Tell.
But you know, when I did that embroidery at Art Basel,
yes,
I was thinking about you when I made some of those characters.
You're kidding?
The ones flying in the sky, I was thinking of you.
Are you kidding?
God. And I thought, I'm not going to tell her because she won't believe me.
I actually am going to believe you because, you know, there's so many serendipitous things. I thought when I saw the lady with the sash, and remember with Miss South Africa, which was also one of those things. It is kind of part of our culture as well,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
But I remember when I saw the painting, or when I saw the embroidery, I thought of Sun City and I thought of how that was such a pivotal part in my career.
Yeah.
Because it gave me access to so many things that I wouldn't have had access to at that point in time.
Yeah.
So the fact that you, I'm quite honored. Okay, maybe
like,
one day.
That's Joanne.
I might have to acquire that.
The ones flying in the sky.
I'm gonna,
that was you.
Okay. I'm flying. You've taken me to the new level here. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne.
I needed to know that. Daniel, what I love about your art as well is that you've brought it to the people. Your taxi project.
Oh yes, my
favorite. So that is something. Is that one of your favorite children?
It's my favorite.
So tell me about that. And just for context, please tell people about it and why you decided to do it.
Well, I made a film, Kasaram, mm-hmm. and this film just went. I mean, it went mad. It just went everywhere, all over the world. I don't know how it happened, but it happened.
This was a film you made during lockdown.
Yeah, so it's a film I made during lockdown. You know, I wanted to make it before lockdown, and I was speaking to some production companies, and they were giving me the most. It's relevant. It just was a very expensive film to make, and I didn't have the budget. And then during lockdown, I said to my husband, "Let's just try and make it in the lounge," and we got some. Cheap fabrics from Kwai Lapis. Yeah, I think it was like 9 rand a meter or 7 rand a meter. And we covered the whole lounge with this green screen made from this cheap fabric. And my sons, they played all the parts, and my husband played some parts, and my cousin and myself. And the family had to come and drop costumes at the door because we weren't allowed to see each other. And so it took us 6 months. We had to YouTube tutorials of how to do things.
We had time.
Yeah. We had time.
we had time, right? Yes.
So it took us 6 months to make this 12-minute film. And in the end, I showed it to the Smithsonian during lockdown, and they immediately wanted the film. And then every single, like, it's been on every continent. It went everywhere. I can't count how many museums it's been in. And God, now I forgot the question. Sorry.
Kasaram. Basically, the taxi art.
Oh, so the taxi art.
How did Kasaram get to be in the taxis?
But the whole thing is that the whole film, the sound and everything was inspired by the taxi and inspired about, it's a cape. It's for the cape. Mm. The film is for the cape. It's for the people of the cape. And I couldn't understand why there was no access. The people I make the work for have no access to the work. And I thought, well, I have to just take it to the people. And I contacted a taxi owner and I phoned Jay Pather up from UCT. And I said, Jay, I'm so unprofessional, to be honest, because you're supposed to like fill out applications and, you know, like write proposals. And I just phoned Jay and I said, Jay, I really need to do this. And Jay was amazing, said, well, then let's do it. And so as part of Infecting the City, he commissioned the first taxi. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, and then we did it. We actually, I think Jay commissioned 4 taxis, yeah. Since then, and that's what we did. We then wrapped it. We put a screen into the taxi. We did the art around the taxi. We created this immersive experience for commuters. And I think it's been about 4 years, and the taxi's still on the road from Hanover Park to town.
I see the taxi, and I mean, I wish that those were on my taxi routes when I grew up, because I would sit there, I would sometimes like be the side gachi, you know, collecting fare. I would have loved to watch that movie instead of actually listening to what I did listen to in taxis. But yes, it was quite amazing also in the sense that you made art accessible. How do you think we go about making art more accessible in this country and on this continent?
You know, it's so sad because there's so little art spaces available for people. We need space. People need space. Mm. We don't need to dictate what people do in the space. Just by nature, people will be creative in a space. So if musicians need a space, I mean, if you give a community a space, the musicians within the in the community will inevitably use the space because they need it. And that will attract more people from the community and outside the community. If people have a space, people will dance in it. Mm. People will make art in it. I think we just need space. We need space with no rules, because rules is killing us. Rules is anti-art. I hate rules.
Tanya, thank you for making space for all of us in the art world, because I feel that you really are creating such a beautiful, safe, honest space for us to thrive and to make what we make.
Thank you. Thank you, Joanne. Thank you. Thank you for being my muse.
Love it. Love it.